around the 7th century or so. Of all the so-called darshanas, the so-called schools of thought that various texts talk about, Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Mimamsa, Samkhya, Yoga, and so on. Vedanta is really the last one to take off. And it's one that, as we've seen, bases itself largely on the Mimamsa tradition, which is a tradition that is concerned with the interpretation of Vedic texts and to develop a ritual theology around the Vedas, and develops both philosophy of language and hermeneutics to interpret those texts, which then is borrowed by Vedanta authors to apply that to the Upanishads, as we've seen. And so the Upanishads are the anta, the final word of the Vedas. And as we've seen, one of the big contentious issues in Vedanta is the relationship between these two. Is the study of Mimamsa, and by extension, the performance of Vedic ritual, is that a prerequisite for the study of Vedanta? Are these two compatible, or do you only engage in Vedanta after you've given up the performance of rituals that is the focus of Mimamsa? So we've seen that's kind of the debate, where Shankara argues that the two are different, the two are incompatible in most places. He argues that, and whereas Ramanuja argues that the two are compatible, and indeed Vedanta flows naturally from the study of Mimamsa. And you find a number of later followers of Ramanuja, particularly the most influential theologian in Ramanuja's tradition after him is a person called Vedanta Deshika, the teacher of Vedanta. It's a title he gains for his works that he's performed. And he engages extensively with Vedanta. He writes commentaries on at least one of the Upanishads, but he also writes two influential works on Mimamsa itself, arguing for Mimamsa being compatible with Vedanta, as we've seen, Vedanta being the Uttara Mimamsa, the later or the advanced Mimamsa. Now, that's kind of the sort of in broad strokes what we've been looking at in the, at least some of what we've been looking at in the past 2 weeks. And what I want to do today is look at another Vedanta theologian who lived a few centuries after Ramanuja, who lived in the 13th century, a person of many names, as we will see, but who is most commonly known as Madhva, whose sannyas title, or the title that he receives at his sannyas initiation, is Anandatirtha. And he is also from the south, like Ramanuja, like Shankara. He is from the west coast, the west coast of South India, from what is now Karnataka. And he's a very interesting figure for many reasons, as we will see. He's often kind of portrayed, along with Shankara and Ramanuja, as sort of one of the three big Vedanta theologians. And if you turn to a lot of books on Vedanta, they'll just talk about those three and sort of ignore everyone else that was there. In reality, though, Madhva probably would not have been one of the big three if it wasn't for two prominent followers of Madhva after him, who kind of catapult him onto the stage of a broader international stage, a subcontinent stage in the debates on Vedanta. And those two individuals are a person called Jayatirtha and a person called Vyasatirtha. And what both of them are influential for is really bringing Madhva's ideas in dialogue with those of Ramanuja and of Shankara in a way that Madhva didn't quite do. And Jayatirtha is particularly important for the intellectual side of things. He is known in the tradition as the Tikacharya, the teacher of the commentaries, because what he did is most of his works are all commentaries on Madhva's own works, and that's primarily what he did. He wrote just commentaries on Madhva's works. Tradition says he lived after Madhva. The tradition says that he was in his former life, he was the bull that Madhva traveled with that carried all Madhva's manuscripts. And so he heard all the teachings of Madhva and then could kind of disseminate, comment on them in his commentaries. And what he does is he really brings Madhva's ideas in dialogue with Shankara and Ramanuja, because as we will see, Madhva's ideas are quite different from the other two in some respects. But particularly his commentaries are very different in style from the commentaries of Shankara and Ramanuja. And what Shankara and Ramanuja, the way they write, and the way most Vedantists write, would be, here's the verse or the passage they're commenting upon, and they unpack the words of the verse, they kind of comment on what the verse is saying, draw out its implications, quote a few verses maybe in support of it, but generally not that much. And that's sort of it. And then they move on to the next. Madhva's commentaries, by contrast, are immensely terse. And he just makes a few glosses of words and then quotes a passage from a text that is more or less saying what the verse he's commenting is saying, but kind of adds something. And the controversial part of that is that a large number of the texts he cites in his commentaries or texts no one else has ever heard of. He cites about over 250 texts that no one else knows, and which kind of leads later critics of him to claim by the 16th century, a contemporary of this person, Vyasatirtha, from an Advaita tradition, a person called Appaya Dikshita writes a whole book on Madhva just fabricating all these texts to give the impression that what he's teaching is Vedic or Vedantic, but really sort of making it all up. And it's kind of a contentious issue that lives on to this day. And Madhva's followers of Madhva will say, no, these are actual authentic texts. And it's just, he was very well read, and a lot of the texts he cites no one else knows, and so what? You know, that doesn't prove that he made them up. And it's complicated because a lot of texts by a lot of the early authors that are cited are texts we do no longer have. And so it's hard to prove whether he made them up or not. And it's hard to, disprove that he didn't make them up in a sense. But anyway, that's the nature of Madhva's commentaries. What Jayatirtha does is, in writing commentaries on Madhva's works, he then explains what Madhva is saying, explains what the verses he's citing are saying, and then brings those ideas in dialogue with Shankara and Ramanuja, and gives an interpretation of the verse that sort of adheres to Madhva's theology, but that's more in line with what Ramanuja and Shankara are saying. And so often you kind of, if you sort of imagine it sort of spatially, sort of Ramanuja and Shankara are sort of here debating about what the meaning of this particular passage is, and Madhva comes up with an interpretation that's way out there. And what someone like Jayatirtha does is kind of commenting first on that and then bringing that, saying, okay, let's talk about the way Ramanuja and Shankara read it through Madhva's theology. And it's really through Jayatirtha's engagement that Madhva becomes a very important player in the intellectual debates, more so than he would have been on his own. And this is not to kind of, you know, disparage the importance of Madhva or to kind of say that he's not an important thinker. I think he is a very important thinker for a number of reasons that I hope will become clear by the end of this session. But it's really Jayatirtha who kind of makes it easier for the other authors of other schools, the other theologians, to engage with him and his ideas. The other person to do that is Vyasatirtha, who lived in the 16th, 15th, and early 16th century. He similarly writes commentaries on Madhva's works and commentaries on Jayatirtha's works, so you get commentaries on commentaries. But what he's particularly important for, too, is for the political side of things. And what Vyasatirtha does is he gets patronage from the king in the south at that time, the big kingdom of Vijayanagara, which is an immensely influential, powerful kingdom that develops in the south. And he becomes, the tradition says, I mean, the sort of various court documents, and particularly in the Madhva tradition, says that Vyasatirtha becomes basically an advisor to the king, sort of a religious figure at the court. And as a result, there's lots of money that sort of comes into the Madhva tradition. There's lots of temples that are established beyond the home region of the Madhva tradition, which is Karnataka, and it spreads throughout the entire south of India, and becomes, again, a much more influential player. Vyasatirtha himself is really an immensely brilliant mind, and his importance is not just sort of the sort of politically, but his importance is also for the development of the thought of the tradition, as we will see in a moment. And so keep that in mind, that in a sense, when we think of Madhva now, today, and Madhvas themselves, they would see it this way too. They read Madhva always through Jayatirtha. And there's not a lot of scholarship on Madhva, but the scholarship that is there is often by Madhvas themselves, and they'll quote someone like Jayatirtha almost as frequently as they'll quote someone like Madhva. Okay, now, why is Madhva important, or why is he interesting? Is because he comes up with a really alternative system of Vedanta, a very different way of thinking about what the Upanishads are teaching. And part of that is has to do with his eclecticism. He draws on a much wider range of sources than Shankara or Ramanuja did. And we've seen Ramanuja sort of, in a way, systematizing diverse sort of different streams of devotional thought, whether it's the Pancharatra text, those tantric texts I talk about that are used in temple ritual, the Puranic devotional tradition through the Vishnu Purana, the poetry, the regional devotional tradition of Tamil Nadu as it's sort of reflected in the poetry of the Alvar, and then the Vedantic devotional tradition that he inherits from his own gurus. And he kind of brings those all together in his tradition. Madhva is sort of reaches out to other texts that and other sort of streams of thought that before that have not been so central to devotional thought and to Vedantic debate. And you see this in the types of works that Madhva comments on. And Madhva writes quite a lot. Most of his works are commentaries. He has 10 independent theological treatises that are generally fairly short. And then he writes a whole bunch of commentaries. He writes commentaries on the Upanishads. He writes three commentaries on the Brahma Sutras themselves. He writes commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita. He writes a commentary on the Mahabharata. He writes a commentary on the Bhagavata Purana, which we will see in a few weeks becomes an immensely important text for the Northern Vedanta traditions. He writes a text on the Pancharatra corpus, on the importance of those texts. But then he also writes a commentary on part of the Rig Veda itself. And kind of what he's doing is kind of saying, okay, one of the things that he's teaching is that what all these texts are teaching, what the entire corpus of, if you remember the Shruti texts and the Smriti texts, so the Shruti being the Vedas and the Upanishads, the Smriti being everything from the Puranas to the Dharmashastras to, you could include the Mahabharata and Ramayana, as we've seen, they're often classified separately, as well as the Pancharatra. He says all of this establishes the supremacy of Vishnu, and all of this teaches devotion to Vishnu in some form. And so he writes commentaries on all these texts to kind of show how this is done, how you can read those texts as being establishing that. And you see this, for example, in his commentary on the Rig Veda, which is only a partial commentary. He doesn't comment on the whole thing. But he sort of reads the text as an entire text, not in praise of the various gods that are worshipped in Vedic ritual, but actually as a text in praise of Vishnu. And sort of comments on the sort of, I forget how many of the hymns, about 60, I think. And then it kind of, he leaves it off, and it's kind of basically, you get the gist sort of, okay, this is how you can read, you can figure out the rest yourself, how to read it. And now, that importance on the supremacy of Vishnu, we've already seen with Ramanuja, but this kind of gets an added significance in the thought of Ramanu, in the thought of Madhva. Because Madhva is unlike every other Vedantic, major Vedantic tradition, Madhva does not posit an Advaita or some form of non-dualism, but posits dualism. And he argues, and you see this in, if you look on the handout, there's a picture of him there. And he will always be depicted in a similar pose, holding up two fingers, stressing two, the difference, duality. Now, as I kind of hinted at last week, Madhva's concept of duality is not as simple as it sort of seems, and there are elements of Advaita in his thought. But basically what he says, the basic dualism that we have is a dualism between the... between the independent and the dependent. Or in Sanskrit, the Swatantra and Paratantra. And basically the independent has only one being in there, which is Brahman or Vishnu, which is God. Everything else is dependent on Brahman for its existence. It cannot exist without the existence of Brahman. It is controlled and ruled by Brahman, and it cannot exist on its own. And so this is the basic duality. Now, in this sort of positing of a duality, which is so central to Madhva's thought, you can sort of see, okay, yes, this is a duality, but it's kind of leaning to a sort of a notion of Advaita that we've seen with someone like Ramanuja. Madhva argues that here, okay, the two main categories that we're concerned with here today is matter and the living beings, the jivas, which is us. And he says those things are different from Brahman. Unlike Ramanuja, Madhva argues Brahman is not the material cause of this world. Brahman creates the world with the pre-existing matter, but matter is different from him. The living beings are different from Brahman. And yet, at the same time, he argues that those have no separate existence from Brahman. And he argues that if Brahman desired for me, for example, not to exist, or any living being to not exist, we would all cease to exist. And if Brahman desired that matter, which is different from him, did not exist, matter would cease to exist. And so, yes, this is a dualism. This is an emphasis on difference between the two. And yet, it is not such a clear-cut difference, because you cannot think of these independent or sort of separately from Brahman. And now, Madhva has to deal with a couple of issues in stating the difference between the two. And one of the big things is the claims in the Upanishads that the individual self, either, I mean, in the way the Advaitins read it, in the way Shankara reads it, is identical with Brahman, or the way Ramanuja reads it is in some ways one with Brahman. How do we deal with that in this system? Madhva argues that the properties of the individual self seem to resemble the properties of Brahman. They're both conscious, they both have agency, and so on. But he argues that this is true, but we cannot argue that therefore the two are one in some sense, or even are, you know, you could even argue sort of they're equal in some sense. As we've seen, Ramanuja kind of leans more towards that, at least in the state of liberation, where there's a sort of a sameness that you attain. he argues that the way we understand the relationship between these two is like the relationship between a reflection and the object that is reflected. So if you have an object that is reflected in a mirror, the reflection seems to have exactly the same properties as the object that is reflected. And yet, the reflection is different from the object that is being reflected. So if you look in the mirror, and what you see in the mirror seems to be similar to the properties of your body, and yet it is a different. The reflection is not you. It is not the body. And so Madhva likes this analogy because it allows him to say, yes, the two are similar in nature, and yet they're different from each other. But it also allows him to state that God is the reflected, the object that is reflected. The individual self is the reflection, which means the individual self, for its very properties, for its very qualities, for its very nature, is dependent on this, on Brahman. Just as the object, the reflection, is dependent on the reflected object. And so again, you get this notion, this stress on dependence of everything that exists. Now, Dvaita is often translated as dualism. I think it's a misleading sort of way of characterizing Madhva's thought, because as we've seen, it's kind of a dualism that's not as clear-cut as we perhaps would like it to be. And perhaps a better way of thinking of Madhva's dualism is as a system of difference. And this is a thing that recurs in Madhva's teachings, is the fundamental importance of difference. And if someone like Shankara argues that, you know, ultimately there is no difference because the only reality is Brahman, and whatever we perceive is of difference is on a lower level, Madhva actually argues that the ultimate understanding of the nature of Brahman and the nature of this world, the nature of the self, is grounded in difference. Madhva argues that when you perceive anything, the first thing you perceive is difference. When I perceive this chair, I perceive this chair to be different from this desk and to be different from the table. And that's what it means to perceive an object. It's within the perception of an object is part of that is the perception of difference with other objects. And so what Madhva argues is that what we have to come to realize and what the Upanishads are teaching is they're teaching us to see the fundamental differences. And he argues there's five differences that are essential. And if you say, okay, we have God or Brahman, we have matter, and we have the living beings. And what we have to see is that God, that Brahman and matter are different. And this is perhaps the easiest to sort of conceive of. Matter is sentient and so on. Brahman is sentient and so on. We have to perceive that the living beings and Brahman are different. We have to perceive that the matter and living beings are different. And then we have to perceive that one living being is different from another living being, and that one form of matter is different from another form of matter. And these are the five fundamental differences that we have to understand. We'll come to this sort of this part, the difference between living beings in a moment, because it's very characteristic of Madhva's thought. But he argues that this knowledge of these differences will lead to liberation. And of course, the ultimate difference between these here at the bottom and Brahman at the top is what we've talked about. Brahman is independent, everything else is dependent on him. That's the fundamental difference that he repeatedly talks about. Now, as you can see, this is fundamentally at odds with the theology of Shankara and of Advaita Vedanta. And Madhva's, the 10 independent theological treatises that he writes are the primary function of those texts is a refutation of Advaita Vedanta. There's a few that are sort of touching on other issues, but most of them come back to this point of proving the incoherence, the incoherence of Advaita Vedanta, proving that Advaita Vedanta is not grounded in the Upanishads, because it's fundamentally at odds with his system. And it's really the Madhva tradition becomes a very important player in the intellectual scene in India throughout the centuries because of this. It is the Madhva himself starts the critiques of Advaita Vedanta, and it's kind of continued by his followers. Jayatirtha writes an entire work on refuting the notion of the world being mithya, the world being an illusion, as the Advaitins claim. Vyasatirtha writes several works directly critiquing, responding to critiques of Madhva ideas of Advaitins. And it's really kind of the Madhva literature that is produced over the centuries, by and large, is literature of debates, is dialectical texts, is texts that are aimed at refuting Advaita Vedanta and responding to defenses of Advaita Vedanta and responding to the refutations of their own refutations. And so you get this, over the centuries, this immense debate that spreads out over the centuries. Traditionally, Vyasatirtha is sort of seen as the final position that the Madhvas take, although the debate continues up until this day. And on the Advaita side, there is a contemporary of him called Madhusudana Saraswati. Who writes a monumental work called Advaita Siddhi, the perfection of Advaita, which is kind of the response to Vyasatirtha, and that's kind of seen as sort of the most important works in the debate. But the debate continues after that. And it's Madhva's kind of critique of Advaita Vedanta is very interesting. Because it really goes in different directions. Partly it has to do with interpretation of the Upanishads. He will question Shankara's reading of certain passages. He will bring up other passages and say, well, this doesn't fit into Shankara's theology, and so on. As we've seen, Vedanta is a tradition that is based on the interpretation of the Upanishads, and therefore a lot of theological debate really has to do with hermeneutics. It's about how to read this particular passage, how to understand this, and so there's lots of grammar that is involved and so on in the analysis of texts. But Madhva goes a different direction too, and Madhva critiques Advaita Vedanta on logical grounds as well. And there's a lot of works on logic that are produced in the Madhva tradition as trying to show that not only is Shankara's reading of the Upanishads not very convincing, or his ideas are not taught in the Upanishads, particularly they critique the Advaita notion of the nature of the world as being, neither real nor not real. Well, you cannot say that it is real, and you cannot say that it is not real, as we've seen, as not being grounded in the Upanishad. That's a recurring critique of them. But then on the other hand, their arguments are too that Advaita Vedanta is just incoherent. It is self-contradictory. Madhva argues, like Ramanuja, that Brahman is a personal deity, it is Vishnu, and therefore has, as Ramanuja argues, an infinite number of attributes, whereas Shankara argues that Brahman has no attributes. What Madhva argues is that the notion of something attributeless is logically incoherent, because he says at least what you have to argue that attributelessness is an attribute of the thing, and therefore it kind of contradicts itself. And so he invests a lot in logic and kind of goes that route to refute Advaita Vedanta. It's similarly with the nature of the world. It's the two main targets for Madhva in Advaita Vedanta are the nature of Brahman as having no attributes and the nature of this world. And in the matter of the nature of this world, Madhva has a lot to say as well. He draws extensively on debates or ideas about epistemology in Mimamsa. One of his theological treatises that he writes is actually on epistemology. And it's really, he's kind of talking about the way we obtain knowledge in order to then use that to refute Advaita Vedanta. He argues that, the Mimamsakas argue that knowledge is self-validating. And it's one of the fundamental principles for proving establishing the authority of the Vedic text, where Mimamsa argues that when one of the means of knowledge leads to actual knowledge, there's nothing that needs to prove that knowledge that you have obtained. And so the standard analysis is there's three means of knowledge. There's direct perception. There's inference, and there's testimony, which is particularly Vedic testimony, or scriptural authority. With sense perception, direct perception, we perceive the world around us. I perceive there's a chair, I perceive there's people in this room, I perceive there's a sun, and so on, outside. With inference, I can come to reliable knowledge about things that are beyond the range of my perception, but still within this world. So the standard analogy is, or the standard example is, I perceive smoke on the mountain, and because I perceive smoke on the mountain, I can infer that there must be fire on the mountain, even though I don't perceive the fire directly, because whenever there is smoke, there is fire, as we perceive in the kitchen, and therefore I can infer there is fire on the mountain, even though I only perceive the smoke. Inference can lead to reliable knowledge. And then finally, there's testimony, particularly the testimony of the Vedic text, which the Mimamsa argues teaches dharma, as we've seen. And the Vedanta says it teaches Brahman. Now, Mimamsa has this argument that not just the Vedic testimony, but every means of knowledge does not require any proof in and of itself. So in other words, and this is particularly important with the a revelation of the Vedic text, which Mimamsa says teaches about dharma. So their argument is that the Vedic text teaches about dharma. Now, dharma is not known through either of these other two means of knowledge. If it was, then the Vedic revelation would be superfluous. It would have no special function. And so dharma can only be known through the Vedic text. And there is nothing that can prove that the Vedic text teaches about dharma in a sense, other than themselves. If we could prove through inference, for example, that the Vedic texts are an authoritative source on the knowledge of dharma, then inference would be higher than these texts. And that would kind of mess up with the neat compartmentalization of these ideas. And so it's kind of, Mimamsa argues, it's sort of in a sense a circular argument. It might seem like that, but they say there's no way around that. They say even my perception that it's sunny outside now, that perception, if there is actual perception that's taking place, there's nothing else I need to do to prove that I have perceived that the sun is outside, that it's sunny outside. If it were, and I say, okay, well, I can prove this by inference, or I can prove this through another sensory perception, or I can prove this through testimony, then I would have to prove that that proof, and then I would have to prove the proof of that proof, and then so on, and you end up in an infinite regress, and so you cannot say anything. And so they say, therefore, when actual perception takes place, which they define as, you know, when my sensory faculties make contact with the object as it is, and that's kind of the catch, then perception takes place, and reliable knowledge is obtained. The catch is, of course, the object as it is. I might sort of perceive things not as they are. I might, you know, at night I might see a tree and think it's a man, and so on. And there is no right perception that takes place. And so that perception is then proven to be wrong when there is actually correct perception taking place. And so Mimamsa kind of avoids the issue by sort of saying, well, that is not actually perception. If I perceive a man when there's only a tree, we cannot call that actually perception. That's misperception and so on that leads to doubt. Now, the importance for this becomes clear in Madhva's theology. He attaches a lot of importance to this. And this becomes a tool for him to refute Advaita Vedanta, where particularly Advaita Vedanta's notion about the nature of this world. Madhva is a realist. The world is real. And it's one of his recurring critiques of Shankara, or at least of the Advaita Vedanta that develops after Shankara, that this notion of the world being like the superimposition of the snake on the rope and so on is logically untenable, and it's too convoluted and is self-contradictory and so on. And he argues that when we perceive the world, we perceive the world as real. And so there's no need to kind of get into all these, to kind of come up with this notion that, well, the perception we see is true on one level, but not on a higher level, on the level of Brahman. And it's an issue that Shankara himself has to deal with, and he deals with this. And Shankara argues that, Shankara borrows the whole epistemology from Mimamsa, as we've seen, all Vedanta kind of borrows the sort of the theoretical frameworks from Mimamsa. But it's a problem for Shankara, because for Shankara, the self is one, and yet we perceive multiplicity. We perceive there are many selves. We perceive the world as real, and so on. But it's particularly in relation to the self that it provides a problem. What Shankara argues is, he says that, well, the self is not actually an object of perception, because as the Upanishads themselves state, the self cannot be seen and so on. And so therefore the knowledge we have acquired of the self is really not knowledge. It is not perception, but it's part of this superimposition unto ourselves, unto the pure consciousness that is the self and Brahman. And so when I perceive you and so on as being different, when I come to actual knowledge of that, I realize that the knowledge that I thought I had about you being different from me and so on is not actually knowledge, and it is sublated, it's sort of removed by the correct knowledge the moment the correct knowledge arises. And so I perceive that there is only a rope and no snake, and immediately the perception of the snake vanishes. And so that's what happens in the state of liberation, of enlightenment, or whatever, however you want to call it, is you realize that actually what you have been seeing as sort of multiple is actually part of that false perception. So this is applied to the world as well in Advaita Vedanta, where then the world is sort of perceived to be not real. And it's a thornier issue for Shankara than the perception of the self, because the perception of the self, he can argue, okay, well, the self cannot be perceived, so there's not actually any real knowledge that's taking place. The world he gets into, or at least later Advaita Vedantins get into some difficulty with, because of this insistence that the world is neither not real, and or we cannot say that the world is not real, and we cannot say that the world is real, and as sort of having this very ambiguous ontological status. Madhva kind of employs all this to kind of argue, well, the simplest explanation, this is sort of a basic principle of Mimamsa, the simplest explanation is always the best. The most economic reasoning and interpretation of a text is always the one preferred. And so he argues that based purely on epistemology, we can see that the world must be real. And the world is real because it's an object of our perception. And that sort of seems a simple argument, but it's kind of he really gets into the issues of epistemology and the relationship between these three to make that point. And it's because this point is such an important point for him that Madhva is often called a realist. You'll find a lot of textbooks kind of saying, oh, he's a realist, or as they themselves call themselves, he's a tattvavadi. The Madhva tradition themselves call themselves the tattvavadis, those whose philosophy is that of tattva, of sort of ontological real entities. And those are the different ones that we've seen, and the sort of the importance of understanding the real distinctness of all those categories. And a lot of Madhva's, or a lot of later Madhva thought, kind of is involved in sort of mapping all those differences out. And if you look at, you know, sort of introductory books on Madhva Vedanta, you'll find often sort of big charts of all the different categories of being that exist within here, within there, and so on, and all the differences that we find there. Now, just in closing, there's one more important category of Madhva's thought that we have to talk about, and that is the difference between one living being and another living being. And it is there that we kind of get into Madhva's most distinct ideas and most unique ideas. And Madhva is someone who thinks in terms of hierarchy in everything that he does. And when he talks about different types of living beings, he talks about hierarchy as well. There's two issues that are important here. One is that, unlike any other Vedanta school, Madhva argues that not all living beings are the same. And if we, you know, if you talk about Shankara and talk about Ramanuja, one of the fundamental ideas is that we have to come to see the nature of the self, and the nature of the self in Shankara, there is only ultimately one self. In Ramanuja, there are individual selves, but in their nature, they're all the same. And so myself is the same as in quality, in sort of nature as yourself, and so on. Madhva argues, no, this is not the case. And he argues there's three types of selves. He says there's some selves that can attain liberation. They're eligible for liberation, and they can follow the path of Vedanta and attain liberation, which for him is similar to Ramanuja's understanding, is some form of union with Brahman in the divine realm. The other two categories, Madhva argues, they cannot attain liberation. And so not every living being is able to attain liberation. He says there are some who are nitya samsarins, who will be perpetually reborn in samsara. And it's just, that's their nature. And there are some who are the third category, then there are some who are destined, as he puts it, they're tama yogis. They're destined, they're sort of fit for darkness. And those are demonic beings. They're beings that are inherently cruel, inherently sort of have evil motivations. So it's, you have those three categories of being. And those three categories of beings, we don't know which one we are. It's just, we could be either of those three. Probably not the last one, or there's a good chance not the last one, because those are destined to be reborn in demonic life forms. But there is a possibility that we are one of those as well. And it's a controversial idea, because it means that not everyone can actually attain liberation, and not everyone is therefore, there's no point for everyone to study the Vedanta and to strive for liberation either. Though Madhva says, well, because we don't know we are, you kind of have to try for it. And if it proves not to work out, then okay, so what? you have nothing lost. And if it proves it did work out, then you've gained everything. But contemporary Madhvas will use this often as to argue for to address the problem of evil, of theodicy. Why is there evil in this world if there's a compassionate and omnipotent and omniscient God? Why is there suffering in this world? And at least the suffering that is due to other living beings, contemporary Madhvas will often say, well, that's this third category of living beings. They're just there, and they cause suffering to other living beings because they're cruel and they're evil by nature. And so therefore the blame does not fall on God for those things. And it works, except if you keep in mind this dependence and independence nature of things. And Madhva's insistence that if Brahman chose for certain dependent beings not to exist, they would cease to exist. So it allows you to address it in some way, but it does lead to other problems as well. It's an idea that we will see the notion of three categories of living beings that sort of surfaces in North Indian devotional traditions, particularly the tradition of Vallabha, who has a similar idea, though a bit reworked. But it's relatively unique in the history of Vedanta. There's few authors who argue for this. But the other side of the difference between the living beings that is for Madhva important is the notion that there's a hierarchy amongst living beings as well. As I said, for Madhva, there's hierarchies in everything. There's hierarchies in different forms of matter. There's hierarchies amongst the different living beings. There's hierarchies amongst the different gods that exist within this world. There's hierarchies, and this is a controversial point in Vedanta too, there's hierarchies in the state of liberation. Not all those who attain liberation attain the same thing, but there's hierarchies depending on your proximity to Vishnu in the state of liberation. And there's hierarchies in relation to the living beings in this world as well. And on top, the very top of all the living beings, the highest living being, is a deity we've briefly seen before. It's a deity called Vayu, who is the god of wind. And Madhva argues that Vayu is the intermediary between living beings and Brahman and Vishnu. And Vayu, some scholars have, early scholars of Madhva, I thought in the early 20th century, argued that there's a Christian influence there, and that's sort of analogous to the Holy Spirit in Christian thought. But it's actually an idea Madhva gets from the Upanishads. The Upanishads repeatedly talk about the importance of prana, of life air, which... and prana is often linked to Vayu in the Upanishads as well. And the Taittiriya Upanishad says that Vayu is pratyaksham brahma, is the manifest Brahman. And so it's kind of in the Upanishads, you have this emphasis on Vayu and prana already. And Madhva kind of draws on that and says, yes, Vayu is the supreme living entity. He's the best living entity that is the devotee of Vishnu, because what he does is, as prana, as life airs, as we've seen, are those things that animate the body. And so every action that we perform is dependent on prana. We have the in and out breath and so on, where you have the upward and the across and the downward breath and so on, which are the pranas that animate the body, that allows us to perform actions. And so every action that we perform is dependent on Vayu for us to perform it. And so every action that is performed in this world is offered by Vayu to Vishnu, to Brahman, because Vayu is Vishnu's best servant, and therefore whatever he does as service to them. And so through our actions, what we have to come to realize is realize our dependent nature on Brahman, and then dedicate our actions to Vishnu, to Brahman, through the grace of Vayu. Now, there's one final sort of catch to this, or one final sort of addition to this, and that is that Madhva himself, in several of his works, says he's the third avatar of Vayu. And you have a passage here in the handout, and this is from the end of his commentary on the Mahabharata, that you have the kind of, as is customary at the end of text, or as often done, the author will say, well, this text is written by such and such. Sometimes they'll say at such and such time and so on. But Madhva comments, he says, the sage Ananda Tirtha, which is a name he received when he became a sannyasi, called Supurnaprabhya, which is another one of his names, wrote this book, the Mahabharata Tatparya Nirnyadi, Investigation into the Meaning of the Mahabharata. He was taught in Badrikashrama, in the Himalayas, by Narayana, by Vyasa himself. And Vyasa, in the Madhva tradition, is seen as an avatar, a descent of Vishnu or Narayana. And the Madhva hagiographies tell how Madhva made two visits to Badrikashrama in the Himalayas, where Vyasa, who is the sort of the legendary redactor of the Vedas, who divided the one Veda into four, who wrote the Puranas, who wrote the Mahabharata, and who traditionally is also seen as the author of the Brahma Sutras, the foundational text for Vedanta. And so Madhva is said to have made two trips there and lived there with Vyasa, being taught by Vyasa and being instructed by Vyasa to write his commentaries. And it's very interesting, if you remember, I mentioned that Shankara, it takes centuries before there's actually hagiographies of him. And similarly with Ramanuja, it takes some time before there's actually text being written. The first hagiography of Madhva is written by the son of his direct disciple. So within a generation after Madhva, we have the Sumadhva Vijaya, the victory of Madhva. And so he says, he's talking about him in the third person, which is customary. So he, meaning I, Ananda Tirtha or Madhva, was taught in Badri by Narayana. He is the disciple only of the sole preserver of the world. By his grace, he properly understood the Vedas in their entirety with the Pancharatras, ritual texts. Although Madhva, they have theology as well, and Madhva draws on their theology extensively as well, which summarize their secrets, the Itihasas, the Ramayana and Mahabharata, and the Puranas, as well as all other sciences. This book conclusively establishes the meaning of all scriptures, specifically following the Mahabharata. It was composed by one who pleased his teacher, Hari, Vishnu, Vyasa, the origin of the world. Without him, there is no final exposition. Krishna, or Vishnu, composed the Brahma Sutras based on the statements in their entirety, which correspond exactly to those put forward by other sages. Anyway, he goes on. And then in the next paragraph, it says, ordered by Vyasa, the third avatar of Vayu, meaning Madhva, explained the Brahma Sutras, and after composing another excellent commentary on them and various other commentaries on the Upanishads, establishing that all these texts teach that Hari Vishnu is the Supreme Lord, he wrote his present work in order to illuminate the true meaning of the Mahabharata. The devotees of Hari, whose knowledge is perfect, rejoice at this. This is established in the following passage, as well as in the Puranas and the Pancharatra Samhitas, and then follows a verse from the Rig Veda that's immensely important for the Madhva tradition. And this is Madhva's reading of it, where he says that, where he talks about the three avatars, the three manifestations of Vayu in this world. And they're talked about in the Mahabharata and in the Ramayana, where in the Ramayana, Hanuman is said to be an avatar or the son of Vayu. In the Mahabharata, Bhima, one of the Pandavas, one of the warriors who fights to regain the kingdom, as we've seen last term, is said to be the son of Vayu, which in the Madhva tradition is taken to be an avatar of Vayu, descent of Vayu. And so whenever Vishnu descends in this world, Vayu will descend in this world as well to assist him in his mission. And so when Vishnu descends as Ram, then Vayu descends as Hanuman to help him conquer Ravana and return Sita. When Vishnu descends as Krishna, then Vayu descends as Bhima, who's the sort of the powerful warrior on the Pandava side, to assist him in regaining the kingdom and establishing Yudhishthira as the king. And when Vishnu descends as Vyasa, Vayu descends as Madhva to assist him in his mission. And so when Vishnu descends as Vyasa, in the Madhva tradition, they say, well, his mission is to establish the teachings of the Vedas and to establish the correct interpretation of the Vedas, which Vyasa tried to do through writing the Puranas and the Mahabharata and the Brahma Sutras and so on. And so Madhva descends as well to assist him in that. But just as Vishnu, whenever he descends, he has to defeat various demons that try to mess up his plans and so on. So Madhva has to defeat the demons as well, chief of which is Shankara, who was born several centuries before Madhva, which Madhva then combats intellectually. And this is really kind of the mood in the Madhva tradition. This is how they view Shankara. And so this whole debate that we've seen in the refutation of Shankara's interpretation of Brahman and of matter and so on, this is part of their understanding of the position of Madhva in assisting Vyasa in his mission. And it's something that you don't get in kind of, if you read, you know, the works of Jyotirtha and Vyasatirtha and most of Madhva's works either. But this is kind of what comes out in the more devotional texts written about Madhva and in a number of places in Madhva's own works where he himself makes that claim for that. And so within the living beings, there's a hierarchy as well. Vayu is on top, and we can attain the grace of Vishnu through the grace of Vayu. And so through the understanding that Madhva gives us, we can come to know Brahman and attain liberation. So lots of interesting ideas. And we'll see, we'll return to some of these in later weeks when we look at other schools that draw on Madhva and some of Madhva's ideas. But you can see sort of he is kind of a very different Vedantist than the others. He has a very different understanding of how we should read the Upanishads and how we should make sense of the tradition, the Vedic tradition in its broadest sense, including sort of the Smriti and the Panchatra text, as all establishing the same idea. Next week we'll remain in the south. We'll move back to Tamil Nadu, and we'll be looking at Shaiva traditions that developed there, devotional Shaiva traditions.